far as we know, there's only one psalm written by Moses. But what a beautiful one in Psalm 90 when he said, Lord, Thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever Thou hadst formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, Thou art God. Thou turnest man to destruction, and sayest, Return, ye children of men. For 1,000 years in Thy sight are but as yesterday when it is past, and as a watch in the night. Thou carriest them away as with a flood. They are as asleep. In the morning they are like grass which groweth up. In the morning it flourisheth and groweth up. In the evening it is cut down and withereth. For we are consumed by Thine anger, and by Thy wrath are we troubled. Thou hast set our iniquities before Thee, our secret sins in the light of Thy countenance. For all our days are passed away in Thy wrath. We spend our years as a tale that is told. The days of our years are 70. And if by reason of strength they be 80, yet is their strength labor and sorrow. For it is soon cut off and we fly away. Who knoweth the power of Thine anger? Even according to Thy fear, so is Thy wrath. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. Return, O Lord, how long, and let it repent Thee concerning Thy servants. O satisfy us early with Thy mercy, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad according to the days wherein Thou hast afflicted us, and the years wherein we have seen evil. Let Thy work appear unto Thy servants, and Thy glory unto their children. And let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us. And establish Thou the work of our hands upon us. Yea, the work of our hands, establish Thou it. Well, 60, 70, maybe 80 years. The psalmist says, Our days are as an handbreadth. Make me to know mine end, and the measure of my days, what it is, that I may know how frail I am. Behold, Thou hast made my days as an handbreadth, and mine age is as nothing before Thee. And this morning I would like to say that I stand here not only as a Christian, but I believe I stand here just alive as a human being. Because of the prayers of a very dedicated, committed Christian father and mother. I had already been a Christian for 5 years, was about to go off to university. I had planned to go to the mission field as a medical doctor. And my mother stood in a prayer meeting one night in our church and told a story I had never heard. But she said that in the winter of 1936... back in the days before the wonder drugs, I was born in a little two-room house down in a town of 300 people in the panhandle of Texas. And at the age of 2, in the winter of 1936, I came down with bronchial pneumonia. And they had the little country doctor out in this other room. And the doctor came out early in the wee hours of the morning and told my mom and dad that I was already turning blue from lack of oxygen. I couldn't breathe, and he said, I don't think Jim can last through the night. But he said, I'll do everything I can. So he went back in, and he kept his finger in my throat all night to keep my windpipe open so that I could breathe. And meanwhile, my mother and father and my grandmother, my mother's mother, and the little country pastor came over and prayed. And here was Mom telling this to the prayer meeting, and she said, we knelt desperate. There was nothing we could do. And we just said, God, if You'll save his life, You can have him. And I'd like to just say this morning that it was my mother and father's influence through which I became a Christian. But I believe it was that night, their prayers, in which perhaps God saved my life and allowed me these 46 years now to live, 34 of them, on this side of the cross. I became a Christian at 12. My dad was in the Navy. And in the summer of 1944, I was riding my bicycle out in front of our house there, and we'd moved over a few miles into Oklahoma, a little town of 3,000 people instead of 300. And I was showing out for some girls out in the street, riding my bike, and riding it as fast as I could. We lived right out on the edge of town with a wheat field down at the end, and there was a dirt road down at the end. And I went around that corner as fast as I could go on that bicycle, and I met a car coming 60 miles an hour head-on. And it hit me and knocked me over the car out into this wheat field, and I came right down on my head. And a medical doctor lived right on the corner. He was sitting on the porch watching it all. And he leaped over the fence. He was not a Christian, and it wouldn't do to quote the words I heard he said. He had often said, that guy is going to kill somebody someday the way he drives. But he went out and administered first aid to me. I woke up 10 hours later in the hospital. And it was shortly after that that my mother decided that just taking me to church was not enough. I calculated one time that by the time I was 12 years old, I had attended over 3,000 meetings in my church. We went Sunday morning Sunday school, church, Sunday night young people's or whatever it was at the time, church, Wednesday night prayer meeting, and we never missed it. It was not even a matter to be discussed in our family. I don't know that we ever discussed it. I don't want to go to church. Nobody ever said that. We just did. It was kind of the law of the Medes and Persians. But I was a very frustrated kid at that point in my life, at about the age 10, because with all this knowledge from these godly Sunday school teachers and pastors, I knew the answers, I knew the facts of the Bible, but I didn't have the power of Jesus Christ in my life. I didn't know Him personally. And it was frustrating because I was the most faithful kid on the school ground and going to church, and yet my life was no different than the other kids. Well, after that accident, a few weeks later, Mom called me in one Saturday morning, and I could tell she was a bit nervous. And she witnessed to me. She said, "Jim, Dad and I have taken you to church all our life. We've tried to rear you in the faith, but we want you to know that our faith is not sufficient for you." And she had never heard of the Navigators, but she used an illustration of a ship. She said, "Jesus Christ is the captain on the ship of life, and Jim, he needs good crew members. Would you like to be one?" And I really wanted to be a Christian. I wanted that power, but I couldn't see. My eyes just weren't open to the simple act of faith. And I kept going to this church, and they gave an invitation at every meeting in the church, every meeting. And I would sit on the back row. I'd try to get as far away as I could because I was under such tremendous conviction. And I'd sit there and I'd grip the back of the seat and I'd pray, "Oh God, if you let them sing one more verse, I'll go forward." But I wouldn't do it. Finally, 2 years later, my dad came home from the Navy. The war was over. And I wanted to get away from Mom and Dad and the church and God and everybody. So I went to this summer camp. And I got over there and it was a church camp. And there were about 300 of us kids out under the open stars every night as a man preached. The preacher was not my pastor. But on the third night of the camp, July 3rd of 1946, we were sitting there listening, and some other fellows and I had pulled our bench back away from the other seats out under the trees. And I don't remember a word the preacher said, but when they stood for the invitation, I didn't have a bench in front of me to hold onto. And my pastor, who was really a man's man, he played the trumpet, he'd been a football player in high school, friendly, warm. I often had said, "If I ever become a Christian, I want to be one like Frank." And that night, I saw Frank walking around behind the trees. And I thought, "I wonder where he's going." And I was standing there, and all of a sudden, I just felt this sinking feeling in my stomach as I felt a hand on my left shoulder. And I looked up into his dark, black, compassionate eyes. By the way, he's a pastor today in Oklahoma City. I just talked to him on the phone the other day, and we're going to get together. And the pastor of my church in Norman was also led to Christ by him. So we're going to have a little reunion and thank Frank for his part in our life. But as he looked into my eyes, he said, "Jim, wouldn't you like to be a Christian?" And that night I went forward, so to speak. Now, everything happened that would militate against my becoming a Christian. Nobody prayed with me. Nobody asked me what I'd done. He said, "You're coming forward. Do you want to be a Christian?" "Yes." And I stood with a bunch of other kids. But you know, I often tell people, I know I was converted that night because we were sleeping out under the trees, and a kid came to camp who didn't have a cot, and we were using these old army cots that had the little wood slats down the side, and we pushed two of them together, and I volunteered to sleep in the middle. And I remember laying there, racked out on that board, that little narrow board right in my back, but looking up into the heavens, and for the first time in 12 years, I had peace. I knew that Christ had come into my heart. And it was like all those years of instruction from my mom and dad were like gasoline. And that night, the Holy Spirit just gave me the faith, and it ignited. But the first 3 years of my Christian life were sort of up and down, and I kind of went from meeting to meeting and camp to camp. And there was not much consistency in my life. And at the beginning of my sophomore year in high school, my pastor said to me one day, he said, "You know, Jim, you could take the dips and curves out of your Christian life if you'd read your Bible every day and pray." And I was involved in a lot of school activities, and so what I'd do is come home, and my pattern was to eat supper, study a little bit, and go to bed about 8 o'clock or 8:30, and then I'd get up around 5 or 5:30. I've always been a morning person. I just enjoy the morning. And I'd get up and do my algebra and translate my Latin and all that. And so what I did was set the alarm about 20 minutes earlier, and I started getting up and spending time with God in the winter of 1949. And God really began to speak to my heart. And my 3 years in high school were lived very close to the Lord. I enjoyed Him. I fellowshipped with Him. I asked my pastor one day, "How do I witness? How do I tell people about Christ?" So he gave me a list of 10 verses, and I copied the references in the back of a little New Testament. And so I'd pray for my classmates, and in my senior year, I finally got the courage up to witness to some of them, and I'd invite them home, and my mom was a terrific cook. So I'd invite them home one by one to have dinner, and Mom would feed them. Then I'd drive them home, and on the way home, I'd stop at a park, and I'd say, "Would you like to know how to become a Christian?" And every one of them said, "Yeah." So I just looked, peeked back at the reference there, and I'd read the verse and then ask them if they wanted to invite Christ into their life. And in my senior year, God let me lead 10 of my classmates to Christ. But when I went to college, I was really disillusioned because not one of them was going on with the Lord. Oh, I got them baptized, they were in the church, but not one of them was going on, and it was in that vacuum of disillusionment that I met Dawson Trotman in my freshman year. And when I heard Doss talk about spiritual pediatrics and follow-up and building into somebody's life, I thought, that's it. That's what was missing. And I just sort of stumbled into it. Every time the navigators had anything that was anywhere, I'd go to it. At the end of my freshman year, 6 of us got a drive-away car and drove all the way to Forest Home, California for a summer conference. As Dan has already told you a little bit about my background, after graduating from Baylor, I decided God didn't want me to be a doctor. I wanted to be a navigator. I wanted to give the rest of my life just to helping people the way others had helped me. And I met my wife right here in the castle, down in room 203 where Lila's staying. She had just moved in there in 1958. We both came to the Glen at the same time. And I was giving a tour through the castle, and that was the only room in the castle that had drapes and carpets. So I would always show that room. It was kind of the showroom on tours. So I knocked on the door, and this beautiful girl opened the door. I didn't know who she was, but I said, "Would you mind if we show these people the room?" "No, fine." And so she had just come here to work. Well, to make a long story short, 3 years later, we were married. And then Lincoln, Washington, D.C., Africa, and back here. And I look back on my life, and the psalmist said, "And if they be 80 years, yet is their strength labor and sorrow." Because of Jesus Christ, the climate of my life has been one of great joy. I feel God's goodness has been overwhelming to me. But all along the way, the Lord has just allowed enough suffering and heartache to come into our lives to really keep us pressed to Him. to make us know that it's not by might nor by power, but by my Spirit, saith the Lord. And this morning, what I want to speak to you on is what I would do different if I were starting over as an area representative or a contact staff with the Navigators. 22 years ago, my wife and I came on the staff of the Navigators. 20 years ago, I went out into my first field assignment like many of you are doing. And what I'm going to share with you this morning are some mistakes I feel I have made. Dick Halverson told me one time, he said, some of the greatest lessons in life that I've learned from Christian leaders is not what to do, but what not to do. I asked Lauren one time, I said, Lauren, when you went out on your first assignment to Seattle, Washington, what did you do? And he said, well, I'll tell you, but if I were going back, I wouldn't do that again. It's kind of like the old German who said, we're too soon old and too late smart. Or like the young aspiring businessman went to the old successful businessman and he was going to try to learn a lesson. He said, sir, what's the secret of your success? And the man said, well, good judgment. And the young guy says, well, how do you get good judgment? And he said, well, you get it by experience. Oh, is that right? Well, what kind of experience? And he said, bad judgment. We have two principles in Scripture that are not in conflict, but Paul said in Philippians 3, 13 and 14, forgetting the things which are behind, forgetting what is back there, I press toward the mark. And there's a sense in which we need to forget our past successes and especially our past failures. But there's another sense in which, in 1 Corinthians 10, Paul said in verses 11, 12, and 13, now these things happened to them as an example that they were written for our instruction upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. And I believe that sometimes the way that God enables you and me to escape temptations is to hear how someone else fell into them. We learn from example. And Paul said here, these were written for your instruction. Now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, you're going to have a lot of war stories if you keep walking with the Lord, and God's going to use you, and He's going to bless you if you keep close to Him, and you're going to be able to tell people a lot of things that you did right. And that's going to encourage people too. But I thought this morning that what I would do is just tell you some mistakes I made, that if I had to do over again, I'd try not to do it. And some of them I'm still working on. I hope I've made progress. And with many of these, it's a process. But let me share this. First of all, I feel a mistake I made in my early ministry was not confronting a person when I sensed he was in danger. Now, I came from a home. I'll tell you where I think I got this. My mother and father were tremendously trusting of me. I can never remember a time when I didn't feel they had confidence in me. And they let me learn a lot of lessons on my own. There's a few times when Mom and Dad set me down and warned me about some things, but they were very accepting. Dad never told me when to come in. They always asked me when I was coming in and held me to that. And Mom said, there's only one thing I want. When you come in at night, come kiss me goodnight, because I won't be asleep. Just come kiss me goodnight. I didn't realize till about a year ago why she did that. It never dawned on me that if I had been smoking or drinking, she could have smelled it. And it never dawned on me in those years but she didn't ask me, where were you last night or what were you doing or this type of thing. And so I sort of grew up with kind of wanting to give other people a lot of rain, just as long as they weren't over close to the edge. Leave them alone. Let them learn. Hebrews 3:13, though, says, "But exhort one another daily while it is called a day, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin." And in my first assignment with the Navigators, we had a young fella. He was a sophomore when I got there. He had just been converted the year before. And I told my wife one day, "I have never in my life seen a young man as young, both physically and as a Christian, that had the gifts and the abilities and the talents in the Christian ministry as that young man did." I said, "Honey, I've never seen a man so gifted." Well, after I'd been there a few months, I'd just been on my first assignment with the Navigators, he enrolled there at the University of Nebraska in a very liberal course of theology in the School of Philosophy. And I just thought, I heard he was doing it, and I thought, well, he'll come out of that. And the next thing I knew, someone came to me and said, "So-and-so is not having a quiet time anymore." And I went to talk to him about it. I says, "Here, you're not having a quiet time." And he says, "Yeah," he says, "I'm just beginning to wonder how much of my effectiveness is due to my own personality and how much of it's due to God. So I'm going to run a little test for 6 weeks. I'm not going to read the Bible or pray and see if it makes any difference." Well, now I did put in a confrontation at that point. I said, "Well, let's call him Bill." I said, "Bill, you can't tempt God. God says man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. And you're tempting God." And he said, "Well, I don't mean it that way, but I've got to prove it to myself." And at the end of 6 weeks, I went to him and asked him, I said, "Well, has it made any difference?" And he said, "Not one bit." And yet every one of us on the campus could see that the power was gone. There was nothing in his life. He later on moved in with a woman. And a friend of mine was visiting in his home a year or two later. And his mother and dad said, "We'd rather go to our son's funeral than to see what we're seeing in his life today." And I think, gang, that I should have gotten more involved in warning him, because that course that he took undermined his whole confidence in the authority and sufficiency of the Word of God. And I just let him walk right into it. But you know, sometimes we don't see things, and we need to pray for sensitivity. I could tell you several humorous stories this morning. My wife and I, several years ago, started praying, "God, when our children sin, let them get caught so they can early learn that sin doesn't pay." And I could tell you some funny stories of how God just let our kids get caught. But it was mainly from a couple of experiences in our early ministry, along with this one, that taught us that. You see, I can't confront somebody if I don't see it. I told God one day, "Lord, I'll make a little deal with you. If you'll point it out to me, if at least I know it, I'll go and deal with it. But I can't deal with it if I don't see it." And one day, one of our key men in one of our ministries came to me, and he soaked my handkerchief with tears as he told me about his fiancée, that she was pregnant. And I prayed with him. And by the way, God has salvaged his life and he's back walking with God. He doesn't have the testimony that he had. He doesn't have the sphere of influence that he would have had this never happened. But the interesting thing is that for about 3 months before he came to me and before that happened, my wife and I would be going home from a Bible study and one of us would say to the other, let's call him Frank, one of us would say, "That comment that Frank made in Bible study, now, what in the world did he mean by that?" It was kind of like an arrow that would go, phew, phew. And just, he would laugh at the wrong time. Or he would say, it just, there was just a little trail of things that weren't right. And I look back, it was a warning. God was telling us, there's something wrong in that man's life. Get in there and find out. But I waited till it was too late. And see, with Ananias and Sapphira, God told Peter, there was something that told Peter that man is in the wrong. And I believe that God will give us the sensitivity to know when something's wrong if we'll be willing then to exhort and to get in there and encourage a brother or a sister in the way everlasting. I believe that that is maybe what is meant by blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Now, if my heart is right with God, I will not only have close, intimate fellowship with Him, but I'll also see whether God is in another man's life or not, or whether He's pleased with another man's life or not. Now, exhorting is not clubbing somebody over the head. We have to speak the truth in love. And by the way, once you confront, if they don't respond, you can't force. Jesus Christ has never forced me to do anything. I remember one occasion where I confronted a man and he just basically told me to take a long walk off a short pier and to leave him alone. And it wasn't an issue of life or death, it just was an issue of foolishness, I thought. And so I backed off and found my heart getting tremendously resentful toward him because it kind of threatened my leadership. And God spoke to me. He said, at this point, you love him and I'll change him. And I just decided I was not going to do any more about it. It had all been talked through 3 or 4 times. And I backed off and it took a little practice, but I really got to where every time I was around him, I just felt the love of Christ for him. And boy, God took him through the ringer. And one day he came back to me and he said, Jim, please forgive me. You are right. But you know, gang, we need to confront. But in Peter, 1 Peter 5, he says, don't be lords over God's heritage. Now, the second thing, that mistake that I feel I made in my early ministry in the Navigators, was using people to make me a success. I had a pastor of a church where I was a member several years ago. He made a comment. I don't remember the sermon, but I remember one statement he said, it is very difficult in the Christian ministry to discern how much of what you do is for the glory of God and how much of it is to meet a personality need in your own life. And let's face it, especially we men, it's important to us to be a success. We want to feel that we are growing in our job and that we're doing a good job. And when we're evaluated, we're growing in it and our supervisor is pleased with us. But we can slip into an attitude of making sure that everybody does something that makes me look good as the leader. My wife came to me one day and she said that my administrative assistant had come to her and said, Jerry, I'm discouraged. He says, no matter how hard I try, I don't feel like I can ever really completely please Jim. And that really hit me hard. Until one day, Jerry said to me herself, you know, she said, honey, it seems to me that it's awfully important how what I do reflects on you. And boy, gang, she was absolutely right. Boy, I was in my 20s, and I was wanting to be a good navigator and grow. But boy, I wanted all these people to behave and do things right out here. And one of the signs, the hallmarks, the indicators of whether or not we really have the right attitude is whether or not we can be patient with other people's failures. And whether our attitude is to serve them and help them become what God wants them to become. I remember one day we were visiting the World's Fair, and we stayed overnight in the King's College at Briarcliff Manor, New York there, and Dr. Bob Cook spoke to our summer training program on Sunday morning, and he said, just yesterday I went out and spent the afternoon and I read all 4 Gospels through at one sitting. And he said, after I got through, I just wrote down my impressions. And he started sharing those impressions with us. And one of the impressions that he saw was the disciples were always failing Jesus. You know, and boy, there, many of us make God kind of look bad in the eyes of people. It happens every day, and yet God doesn't shout from heaven, hey, straighten up down there. I mean, even the young girl that brought the Messiah into the world probably had a reputation that was never cleared up in the eyes of people in Nazareth. And yet God could live with that. God was not insecure. I came to Washington, D.C. on my second assignment, and there'd already been a strong work going there and a strong leader, and I felt a little insecure, and so I wanted to immediately do something to precipitate who was with me and who wasn't. And so I kind of began to turn the ship real quick and set up certain activities that were my own and, you know, choose to be in or out. You can be at whatever level you want. And boy, we had some peel-aways. And one day, Leroy Iams came to the city and he says, hey, by the way, when you came to Washington, D.C., what was your objective? And I said, well, I came here to form a team. And he said, oh, now I understand. He said, I see what the problem is. He said, you didn't come here to form a team. You came here to join a team. There was already a team here when you got here. But you see, I had the attitude because I was the leader that, boy, all these people ought to be subject to me rather than my coming in and just joining them and serving them where they were. And in time, when I had won their confidence and respect, then for us to change the direction of the ship. But using people to make me a success. I think another mistake, a third mistake that I made in those early years was not developing a relationship with my key people. You know, in John 13, he says that by love, all men will know that you're my disciples. It's not our doctrine, it's not our seven imperatives, it's not our doctrinal statement, it's not our vision that tells people about Jesus and convinces, it's our relationship of acceptance and love with each other. In John 17, 20 and 21, Jesus prayed that they may be one. Well, you see, I can't really be of one heart and one mind with somebody by just surface relationships with them. We had a fellow living in our home in the early days of our ministry, and I mean, when he came to breakfast in the morning, you could cut the air with a knife. I mean, there was just tension in the air. As he looked at me, there were just daggers. And one day, my wife came to me, and she said, honey, I love you. I said, for better or for worse. She said, but I tell you this, either he's got to go or I go. She says, I can't take this anymore. And so I kind of took him aside and I said, we'll call him Jack. I said, Jack, I don't think you like me. I said, what is it you don't like about me? And he says, well, I don't like the way you say good morning to your wife when you come to breakfast. And he says, and I don't like the way you hold your fork when you eat. And I said, I kind of threw me a little bit. Well, how do I hold my fork? By the way, I've told this story once or twice over the years at a conference or something, and inevitably somebody comes up to me and says, I don't notice anything wrong about the way you hold your fork, observing how I eat at the table. But I asked this fella, I said, Jack, if Al, one of the other fellows in the home, if he held his fork that way, would it bother you? And he looked kind of surprised, and he says, no, I don't think it would. And I said, well, then the real problem isn't the way I hold my fork, is it? And I knew that we had to get to the bottom of things, and I asked him to take off a day from work, and he and I went out and got a motel room, and I said, let's give our testimony to each other. Not the 3 minute, not the 5 minute, not the 30 minute, but let's give the 2 or 3 hour version. Let's get to know each other. Let's go way back in our life and tell each other where we hurt, where we were happy. Tell about our teachers, about our parents. Let's just get to know each other. So we flipped the coin as to who'd go first. And one of us went, and we spent the whole day getting to know each other. And what had happened was this. I found out what the real problem was. That in this ministry, we had multiple targets, and I had taken a target that really had some sharp people in it. And there was another target over here that didn't have people quite that sharp. And I had put him in charge of that whole ministry. But in the process of doing that, as he gave his testimony, I could see how I had interpreted that as a promotion, as an honor that I'd given him. But when I heard what he had been through in his life, I saw how that was a slap in the face to him. And I was able to clear up that, buddy, I didn't mean to put you down at all. And by the way, we prayed together, we got to know each other, and today he is one of the closest friends that I have anywhere in the Navigators. In fact, every time we meet, we give each other a big bear hug and we're close. But you know, we were working together, but we really weren't inside each other's life. And I've heard this on many occasions before in my years of counseling with George, how easy it is we get busy with so many people. And you can't have deep, intimate relationships with everybody, but gang, we better with our close team. And beyond just what they think about the basics and what they think about the ministry of the Navigators, as human beings, we need to develop a relationship with the people with whom we work. I think a fourth mistake I made that relates to some of these others is not being transparent with my own life with men. I was in Africa, and I got a letter from a fellow who was in IT, who had been in our ministry in Washington, D.C., and in this letter, he poured out his heart about a problem he was having. And he said, this problem has just bugged me for years. And in the letter, he said, Jim, I am so miserable that I had to write somebody, and I wanted to write you. But he said, all those years in D.C., you always appeared like you never had problems. You were always smiling, always victorious, always on top. And he said, I just never felt you would understand. But he said, I am so desperate that I've got to pour this out, and I hope you will. And you know, gang, I wrote that fella back, and I apologized to him. I didn't intentionally deceive you that way. I have problems. I have struggles. I'm a human being with weaknesses and infirmities. But I was laboring under a concept that the leader ought to be the Stonewall Jackson out there. No problems anywhere. Boy, we're just right out there. Come on and follow. But you know, the problem is that disheartens people. They think, well, boy, he would never understand. And in Luke 22:28, just before Jesus went to the cross, he said to his disciples, you are they who have continued with me in my trial. The disciples knew when Jesus was going through. Now, he never sinned. But when he went through struggles, they knew it. This was one of the great things that I greatly admired about Dick Halverson when I was a member of his church in Washington, D.C. Quite often, Dick would get up on a Sunday morning and just share in his message a struggle he had been through that week with his whole congregation. A minister who was a close friend of his, said one day, Dick, you can't let people really get to know you and keep their respect. And he said, well, I seem to be able to do that. Boy, we loved him. And I found that when somebody opens their heart and lets you know where they hurt, it's judged not, I mean, that if we would judge ourselves, we should not be judged. And people just love you when you do that. But I thought it was the other way. I won't have their respect. I can't lead them. Now, there's a right and a wrong way to do it. Ecclesiastes 8:5 says, a wise man's heart discerns both timing and procedure. But we need to be transparent. We need to be real. I think a fifth mistake that I made was laying hands suddenly on a novice. 1 Timothy 3:6 says, "Not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride, he fall into the condemnation of the devil." And I was in this one ministry situation, and it was, we were really busy. We had all these different ministries going, and there was this ministry out here sort of isolated, and we didn't have anybody to send out to lead it, and there was kind of a guy on the grounds that, on the base there, that he kind of had an interest in it. So I said to him one day, I said, "Well, why don't you just lead the ministry out here? You've been to a conference or two, just lead the ministry." And he did. He started leading the ministry. And it began to grow, and people were coming around. And then we had the first leadership conference we'd ever had, a nationwide leadership conference. And Leroy wrote us and said, "Pick out your leaders, or those who are just on the verge of taking leadership ability, and invite them to this big leadership conference." And it was quite an honor to come to this. So I thought, well, you know, that might really encourage that guy if I just invited him to that leadership conference. So I said to him, "Hey, how would you like to go to this leadership conference?" And he said, "Boy, I really would." And he came to the conference, and we had a good conference and went back. And a few months later, I found out that he was being court-martialed for having given a hot check. It came time for him to come to that conference, and he didn't have the money. And instead of tell me and pass up the honor of coming to that, he gave a hot check in order to get here. And the army put him in prison for 2 years. Well, you know, when it happened, I didn't have the attitude I have right now. I had the attitude of, "Why in the world did you do that? That was wrong. That was stupid. Yeah, you'll just sit there in prison and suffer for that." And his wife and two children moved on down to another state to stay with her parents until he got out of prison. And then a few years later, he wrote me and said, "I want to confess to you and ask your forgiveness for the resentment I had in my heart for the fact that you didn't watch after my family while I was in prison." And you know, gang, I had to repent over insensitivity. I thought she was in good hands. I mean, she was sort of uninvolved. She hadn't been part of it. It broke her heart too, and she was with her mom, and they were states and states away and kind of out of sight, out of mind. But you know, I looked back and saw I was part of that sin. I put him in a position that he was not mature enough to handle. And boy, when Paul said, "Don't do it," he meant don't do it. I think, boy, those early days in the Navigators, when we took a Chuck Farah with a PhD from Edinburgh and brought him out here and put him on the paint crew for 2 years, and then I came out of university and I came here as a graduate university and they put me slopping pigs down here. And many times I thought, man, I got more education than to do this. But you know, it's just good that a young man bear the yoke in his youth, to just be on the backside of the desert, to have years of experience, years in obscurity, before you're given responsibility. A sixth mistake I feel I made for about 8 years in the area of ministry, and this is going to be a controversial one, but let me explain it and then see if you don't agree with me. But I didn't observe the Sabbath. You know, now the Bible says some men count one day above another, some count every day alike. Let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. And Paul said, don't let any man judge you regarding a Sabbath. But you know, when Paul said that, he was referring to all these legalistic trappings of the Sabbaths. But when you go back to the Ten Commandments, it's in there, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And when God made you and me as human beings, It's kind of like when you buy a new car, they give you a manual of how often to change the oil, when to do this, when to do that. They don't do it to limit you, but so that you can have a long life for your car, keeping the oil clean. And when God said, take one day and seven out and completely take a change of pace, I think he had two things in mind. One was he knew the human body needed a break just from the routine to get some extra rest. And then I think that he wanted that human being to spend protracted time with him, to get extra time with God. Now, you're really hard put in the scriptures to build a real strong case for the daily quiet time of a certain hour, day after day after day. I think it's a great idea. I do it. But it is in the scripture to spend a day that's a holy day, thinking his thoughts, looking to him, spending protracted time with him. And I was so committed to my ministry and so busy. Someone has said it's a good thing God gives a lot of energy to young people because they don't have much wisdom. And I burned the candle at both ends. I was one of those, every day was alike. I worked 7 days a week. And when my wife and I moved to Africa in 1968, I was almost a basket case. In fact, I had never told a conference this. This was one. It wasn't the only one. It wasn't at the top. But it was one of the reasons I wanted to move with my wife to Nairobi, Kenya, Africa, to get out of the rat race. I was so tired. And in Nairobi, I was 5,000 miles from the nearest navigator with the Red Sea and the Sahara Desert in between us then. And I was tired. And God began to speak to me from the Word that I was violating. And it's not something I have to do. Jesus said, you weren't made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for you. Now, it doesn't have to be Sunday. But I remember Jim Downing coming to Washington, D.C. I'd been there 2 years, been in the ministry 3 years, and he looked at me one day and he said, I don't see how you can possibly do the ministry God has given you to do in this city if you take any less than one day a week just to spend in protracted prayer and thinking and planning. And it just went off of me like water off a duck's back. I thought, Jim, it's not that I need more plans or prayer. I just need to work. I got so much to do. Now, I didn't tell him that because, you know, Jim Downing, gray hair, sitting there telling me I was listening. But I didn't obey him. And, gang, I came close to a point of break physically in my life. In Isaiah 58, verses 13 and 14. God says, if because of the Sabbath you turn your foot from doing your own pleasure on my holy day and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy day of the Lord, honorable, and shall honor it, desisting from your own ways, from seeking your own pleasure and speaking your own word, then you will delight in the Lord and I will make you ride on the heights of the earth. By the way, I think the way I've interpreted that is that you're up where you can see. You'll get a perspective on things when you spend some protracted time once a week just with God. Things will become clear to you. And he says, I will feed you with the heritage of Jacob thy father. Now the heritage of Jacob was the land, which is a picture of the abundant life. Later on with Levi, God said to him, you shall have no inheritance. I am your inheritance. But it'll mean that we'll be able to enjoy the abundance, the riches that God has for us, if we'll just learn how to cut it off, stop, shut the phones off, or get out of the house. But one thing is, for the past 8 years, no, the past 10 years, everywhere Jerry and I have lived, there's been some place just outside the city a few miles where we could go for our protracted time with God, to get away from the phone and everything. And one day Jerry said, I'll tell you how we got onto this, how we really got to going on it. One day Jerry said to me, Jim, the next time you take a day with God, would you take me with you? And I said, yeah, honey, that'd be a good thing to do. I wasn't taking many. And so she came to me another day and she says, hey, when are we going to get that day with the Lord? And I said, well, honey, we'll have to do that. Well, about a month later, she came to me one day with my diary. And she said, put it in the diary. And we took off on this Monday. The kids were in school, and we had a little one about a year and a half, and we got we had an African ayah that kept him that day. And we went outside Nairobi, and we took a bag lunch, got there about 9 o'clock, and we read a psalm, and we spent about 30 minutes just praising the Lord and giving thanks. Then she went over under one tree, and I went over under another, and for the next 2 hours, we just did Bible study, just got in the Word. Then we pulled out our bag lunch, and while we were eating, we shared what we'd been studying. Then we took off down an old dirt road, down through a pasture, out into the forest, and for the next 3 hours, just walked along, hand in hand, praying back and forth, and we'd sit down on an old cow trough, and we'd stop praying and start talking about the needs of the kids, then we'd pray over that, and pray over the needs of the ministry. When we got back to the car, about 4 o'clock, I looked at her and I said, man, why haven't we done this before? And she said, well, I've been after you. And we started every Monday going out to St. Julian's. It was a little retreat place. And I'm telling you, it's one of the highlights of our lives. And God really spoke to us in those days. I felt like it drew Jerry and me together, not only to the Lord, but it drew us together as a couple. But remember the Sabbath. It's a gift to you. It'll make your life last longer. It'll give you greater perspective. And God will feed you with Himself. Now, one last mistake I feel that I made. Let me tell you the story, and then I'll tell you the mistake. One day I was just feeling great. I just had a good time. And I came to my supervisor, and we were going to have 2 or 3 days together. And we sat down, and he looked at me and he said, Jim, we're going to replace you with somebody else. I couldn't believe my ears. He said, I really believe that the job you have, you don't really fit in it. You don't have the gifts and capacities for it, and I think you'd be much happier in a different job. And I'm telling you, gang, I can't describe for you the feeling I had within me. A demotion. I hadn't done a good job. I had failed. Failure was just written in neon lights. And I was just stunned for 2 or 3 days. I walked around in a daze. And I found that I went back home and days turned into weeks, into months, and I found my heart getting resentful. And I thought, well, the navigators can just go take that short, long walk off the short pier. So I kind of began to probe around. There was another Christian organization that wants somebody to come and for the whole organization there in Africa to handle their counselor training and follow up and all that. And I thought, well, you know, they want me, and I'll be important to them. And so I began to sort of probe in that direction. And then one day I was talking with a very godly friend. And he said, now, Jim, honestly, is that work you're thinking about going to, is their whole vision and everything they do, is it more on your heart than what's in the navigators? He said, make sure if you ever make a change, you're not reacting and going from something, you're going to something. And I had to admit, gang, I was looking for something to relieve my wounded spirit. I was resentful. And I got back home, and a few days later, God said to me, Jim, if you don't let me give you the grace for this, you are going to ruin your life. And the mistake I made, gang, was becoming resentful at demotion. And I can't help but be inspired by 1 Samuel 17:15, when it says that God took David from the pasture up to the palace of Saul. And then it says, and David returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. The Christian has got to look at where he can make a contribution, not where he thinks he can be fulfilled. And boy, it's always in the way the human body is put together, you're always more fulfilled in a promotion, never fulfilled in a demotion if you're in the flesh. But to walk in the Spirit means God can do with me whatever He chooses. And that thing had such a grip on me that I had to go out for 4 days of prayer and fasting to break the power of the resentment I had in my heart. And at the end of that time, I said, God, I'll do anything You want. And I'm telling you, I could stand here for the next 2 hours and tell you of blessings that God... And by the way, I lost my job. I wasn't in that job anymore. But I tell you, the years that followed, I have never in my life been so happy. And it may happen again. I mean, we're not... There's a man right now in town today in his 80s that has spent over 40 years out in the mission field. And God has mightily blessed him. And a friend of mine asked him the other day, said, what is the secret of the power in your life of why you are ending so well? And he said, well, he said, one thing is, there's two things. He said, one is, I have done everything I could in my life to stay out of the limelight. But he said, secondly, every time God has blessed me, I've given Him the glory as far as I know. Several years ago, a friend of mine was just graduating from seminary, and just before they graduated, an old white-haired professor looked out at all these students who were going out, and boy, they were really going to go out and establish a ministry. And he told them, his one word of advice to them was, young men, when you go out into the ministry, seek obscurity. And gang, I am appalled just within the last month what I have read and heard in magazines of, it's like David said, oh, how the mighty are fallen. The little poem goes, he who would stand nearest to the captain is the prime target of the archers. And when you get up into a place of prominence, you are a target. And boy, if Satan can get you, many fall. Many are disillusioned. I mean, the devil's no stoophead. He gets the kingpin that'll cause many to stumble. And it's good for us in life to just occasionally have to step down from something. And to just practice that. And so that our fulfillment is not in our job, not in our position, not in what people think of as our promotion, but it's in God Himself. And then if we're even in a sick bed or in a prison, we can rejoice in the Lord. Nothing's been taken from us. It's all turned out to the furtherance of the gospel. And by the way, I want to say today that this particular supervisor with whom I had a problem for several months, I have got the most beautiful relationship with him today. Every time he and I are together, we immediately are before the Lord and praying together. And I thank God for that experience. I needed that. So, I'm sure there are many, many others, but those are some mistakes that I feel that I made. And I'd do things different if I had to do over again. And I may get the opportunity on some.